Welcome to Prostate Cancer Update. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. Anthony Zeitman to learn of his perspective on a variety of clinical research issues currently being addressed in ongoing studies in radiation oncology and in the field in general, and Dr. Zeitman began our conversation by commenting on what he sees as the key current issues in the field.
I think probably the most important thing to emerge over the last couple of years, and that really it's something that affects not only radiation oncologists and urologists, but physicians generally, is this growing awareness that not all prostate cancer needs to be treated. That we have a tsunami of diagnosis, with 250,000 men a year receiving the diagnosis of prostate cancer. And we're becoming increasingly selective in those who we choose to treat. I think the real piece of evidence that changed our thinking came some years back in 2003-2004 when the PCPT trial was reported. This was a trial of finasteride to try and prevent the development of prostate cancer. And one of the most remarkable things to come out of that trial was not just the fact that finasteride did seem to reduce the incidence, but how high the incidence was in the control arm. With over just a 7-year period of observation of men in their 60s, over 25% of men were diagnosed with prostate cancer. Now, what would have happened had those men been followed another 7 years, or 7 years beyond that? We really would be seeing prostate cancer in such frequency in the general population that it could be really akin to going grey as you aged. And really, that piece of information has focused our thinking. And more at the urologic and the oncologic meetings, you find physicians really paying respect to the notion that not all patients with this diagnosis need treatment. Now, there's a difference between paying respect to that notion and actually practicing it, and that is proving harder. And I'm sure we can discuss many of the reasons for that as we go along.
Are there any sort of research leads that may be able to help us sort of figure this thing out?
Well, in an ideal world, there would be a molecular marker that told us, this cancer is a tiger, treat it, this cancer is a pussycat, leave it alone. But we really aren't there yet. What we're trying to do, or what we have done over recent years, is break patients down into risk groups. Those who have high-risk disease, you know, high Gleason grades, high PSAs, we know that they need treatment. Unfortunately, we don't cure them all that often. Those with intermediate risk disease need treatment and are frequently cured. And those with low risk disease, the low Gleason grades, probably in the main don't need treatment at all. Now, our problem is that the high risk group is only 15%, the intermediate risk only 15%, and the vast majority of patients fall into this low risk category. That's 70% of men. Now, there are some men in that group who do need treatment. And the aims of research as we move forward are to try and identify the losers in that low-risk category and treat them and leave all the rest alone.
What's a typical clinical scenario for a patient where you might consider just watching and waiting? And how does that play out as you discuss it with the patient?
Well, until about 5 years ago, it used to be a man with a very small volume, low Gleason grade prostate cancer who's probably in his 80s. And this actually was a very tiny proportion of patients. But the more we understand low-risk disease, the more we realize that actually if men want to undergo watchful waiting or what we now rename active surveillance, they can really do it from any age. So I actually consider men in their 50s and 60s with low-risk disease as being fair game for active surveillance. But it is active surveillance. We have men come back every 6 months for a PSA and a digital rectal exam. We have them re-biopsied at 1 year, and depending upon what that biopsy shows, probably again at 2 or 3 years. We may or may not biopsy after that. So we really are aiming to use surveillance as that missing diagnostic test. You know, we don't have a molecular marker to pick out the tigers from the pussycats, so we use time as a test. And in time, usually those cancers that are going to misbehave will reveal themselves. And when they do, it's not too late to treat those patients.
How do men respond to the whole idea of watching and waiting? I've heard people say that most men can't tolerate it.
Well, that's what's traditionally been said. It simply isn't the case. If you explain this to men reasonably and take the time, actually the majority of those who are suitable for active surveillance choose to follow that line. Often we have a division within the consultation. You'll have the patient himself who chooses active surveillance and the wife who's strongly pushing, or the daughter-in-law who's strongly pushing for treatment. But usually we can encourage people that it's a safe approach. There is a huge randomized trial in Britain called the PROTECT trial that I think many people will be gratified to hear is going on. It's a trial that answers all the key questions, in early prostate cancer at least, in one fell swoop. This is a randomized trial that began early this decade. It's been heavily financed by the British government. And the aim was to randomize 250,000 men to either PSA screening or no PSA screening, to answer the population issue. Does early detection make any difference to the ultimate outcome? Now you can say, well, how the hell are you going to randomize 250,000 men? It's a fair question. Well, in Britain, it's been done not by randomizing the men individually. It's been done by randomizing their primary care practices. So in 9 different healthcare regions in Britain, the primary care practices hang posters on the walls in their waiting room. And they either say, we are a PSA screening practice, or we're not. And if you don't like it, you can obviously have the address of another practice. There's been remarkably little crossover between practices. And I can tell you that all the 250,000 men were randomized by January of this year. So that part is complete. In the arm in which patients are PSA screened, those who have an elevation in their PSA are then sent for prostate biopsies. And if prostate cancer is found, those patients are then randomized, not by a urologist, not by a radiation oncologist, but by one of the 44 research nurses to receive either radiation or a radical prostatectomy or active surveillance. And the extraordinary thing is that these men have accepted randomization. So far, several thousand men have been randomized to surgery or radiation. It'll be nice to have an answer to that question. And the 3 groups, surgery, radiation, and active surveillance, are remarkably balanced. There's been very little crossover between the arms. You might think that all the men would be jumping out of active surveillance towards radiation or surgery, but that actually hasn't happened. And if anything, the crossover is in the opposite direction, with the active surveillance group being slightly larger than the other two. Now, the first report from this trial is coming in 2013, and the final report will be in 2018, which is still 10 years from now. But that's certainly a trial that I think we all wish had been done a decade earlier, but is finally being done.
I guess it'd be nice to see something a little more exciting getting done, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the issues that the National Cancer Institute has been grappling with. On the one hand, you know, there are all these unbelievably basic and fundamental treatment questions that need to be done and haven't been done. And on the other hand, really, the more sophisticated molecular markers, new biologic strategies, all of which will be of much more relevance, certainly to those men who are at risk of dying from prostate cancer, those with high-risk disease. And I would say it's a bit of a struggle at the NCI at the moment to determine where the research dollars are going to be going in the years ahead.
What are some of the cutting-edge questions that are out there on the table right now in terms of radiation therapy for prostate cancer? I guess one issue is the question of conventional dose versus high-dose therapy.
Yes. If a patient needs treatment, then you need to cure him. And there have been many studies over the last decade that have been looking at this concept of escalating the radiation dose to try and improve local control. And every single study so far has come to the same conclusion. There have been 4 or 5 to date. They all agree that higher doses of radiation are more likely to eradicate the cancer and effect a cure. Now, the problem is that higher doses of radiation potentially come at a cost. So if you are going to give high doses of radiation, they have to be given with accuracy. Otherwise, the higher cure rates could be accompanied by substantially higher rates of morbidity.
Now, you reported at the recent ASCO meeting some data looking at side effects and toxicity and high versus non-high dose therapy. What did you see there?
To date, we've just used standard reporting for morbidity. There's a 0 to 5 scale for rectal morbidity or urinary morbidity. But those scales rely on a physician's interpretation of what the patient tells them. More recently, we've been using detailed quality of life analyses. We have a 100-question questionnaire which goes directly to the patient. The physician never sees it. In the quiet and comfort of their home, they can take their time to respond to these questions and mail them back to us. And our latest study found that actually high-dose radiation, as we delivered it in our randomized trial, did not carry a higher risk of morbidity than conventional dose radiation. So that was particularly encouraging. It tells us that with contemporary techniques, we can deliver these doses safely.
What are some of the other controversies and questions in radiation therapy for prostate cancer right now?
Well, the one controversy that really has captured the radiation oncology world and is likely to spill over into other aspects of healthcare is this question of proton beam radiation. And I probably better take a step back and just explain what proton beam is. Regular radiation uses photons or X-rays. These are beams that pass into the body, pass through the tumor, and pass out the other side. Normally what we do is we send multiple radiation beams crossfire into the patient and they intersect over the tumor. But there is a certain radiation dose on the way in and a certain radiation dose on the way out that may or may not affect normal tissues. Proton beam, instead of using X-rays, uses charged proton particles. And these can be accelerated, shot into the body. And unlike regular radiation, the beam can actually be stopped dead in its tracks. So you can irradiate up to the tumor, and then nothing beyond. And there is little doubt that proton beam is a really wonderful way to treat tumors in difficult spots. So melanomas of the eye or tumors at the skull base, tumors in the spine can be treated with extraordinary precision. Pediatric tumors can be treated very easily with protons. But what all these tumors have in common is that they're relatively close to the surface. And it turns out that the proton beam, when you send it deeper into the body, isn't quite as razor sharp as we had once hoped. It has a fuzzy edge called a penumbra. And there's some uncertainties at the end of the proton beam, so you tend to have to overshoot the target. So putting this all together, proton beam is a wonderful treatment for these rare tumors, but its main employment in the United States is in treating prostate cancer. Now, there's a reason for this. A proton facility may cost $100, $150 million to put in. That's a huge investment on the part of hospital, on the part of investors, usually private investors. And that investment has to be recouped. And you don't recoup that kind of investment by treating children and rare tumors of the skull base. These are very time-consuming treatments, involve anesthesia. The only way to recoup that investment is by cranking through the prostate cancer patients. And there are 5 currently existing proton facilities in the United States, with as many as 20 more in the planning stages. So there's going to be a huge explosion of proton beam use. Now, I can assure you that the vast majority of these new places that are being developed have prostate cancer in mind rather than pediatric cancer. And there are huge questions in the future as to whether there is going to be reimbursement for this treatment, as to whether it's ethical to be treating prostate cancer patients with proton beam and not treating children.
What do we know about prostate cancer and proton beam in terms of effectiveness and toxicity?
Well, in the end, proton beam is just radiation. And the kind of radiation doses we can safely give with proton beam seem very similar to the kind of radiation doses that we can give with regular photons or X-rays. The morbidity seems to be very similar. And if you think about this, it makes sense because most of the urinary morbidity comes from the bladder neck and the urethra, which runs through the prostate. There's no sparing that. Most of the sexual dysfunction comes from the irradiation of the nerves as they pass along the capsule of the prostate. and there's no sparing them with proton beam. The only potential advantage would be in rectal toxicity. But even then, the rectum is so closely applied to the prostate that even proton beam can't sort of find a plane between the two. So the data so far suggests that the morbidity of proton beam is relatively low, but we don't see a clear difference between proton beam and contemporary forms of external radiation, like IMRT.
So where do you think this is heading, should head, and maybe you can comment on your paper discussing this, The Titanic and the Iceberg. I like that title.
Well, we are heading, I think, towards a kind of healthcare confrontation. If proton beam facilities just cost $1 million or two to put in, there'd be no big issue. This would all be under the radar screen. The problem is that they cost hundreds of millions of dollars, and that money has to be recouped somehow. Someone is going to pay for it, and in the end, it will be us through our insurance payments and us through our taxes and Medicare. I think it's sharpening our focus in many ways. Here you have a very expensive treatment that costs maybe $50,000 to give to each patient. Many of us believe that you really need proof of superiority before offering that over conventional external radiation, maybe $25,000, or even a seed implant, maybe $12,000, or even active surveillance, $0. And we're going to have to reconcile all of this in the years ahead. And this is not just a debate that's existing within the radiation oncology community. I can assure you that CMS and others in the wider insurance community have begun to sit up and take notice as well.
I'd like to shift over and talk a little bit about systemic therapy. And you were part of a paper looking at a topic that there's been a lot of interest in, which is sort of the metabolic or, I guess, total body changes that men go through who are receiving gonadotropin-releasing hormone agonist therapy for prostate cancer. And your paper on cancer, the first author was Matt Smith, talked about what happens to these men. Can you go through that a little bit?
Sure. Those of us who've given LHRH agonists to patients know that patients experience far more than just hot flashes and sexual problems. Just looking at our patients, we can see that they are changing shape, and they change shape almost before their eyes. It seems to be very rapid. And this was a very detailed morphometric study of men who were treated prospectively, either with bicalutamide or with leuprolide, an LHRH agonist. One thing that's very clear is the LHRH agonists add fat, not anyone really needed to be told this, and men lose bone and men lose muscle. Their total weight may not change very much, but there are huge shifts between fat and muscle. And that these changes really take place quite quickly. You can see them at 3 months, and they are in a fairly substantial way established by 6 months. So even a relatively short course of androgen deprivation can lead to quite profound changes in a man's body habitus. Now, going along with all that, have been other studies that have looked at the development of insulin resistance, which may be behind the incipient diabetes that can be brought out and behind some of the changes in lipids that we see. And all in all, a state rather akin to the metabolic syndrome is created. There are some important differences, but it is, generally speaking, similar to the metabolic syndrome. And that sort of rang alarm bells in everybody's heads. We all know from the dark old days of diethylstilbestrol that giving female hormones to a man can actually lead to cardiac disease. And Matthew Smith, with whom I've been working so closely over recent years, turned his focus on LHRH agonists and was able, certainly in a big SEER database analysis, to identify an increased risk of diabetes and serious heart disease. Now, more recently, other databases have been investigated, and there's some confusion in the field, but the general feeling is that older men are at increased risk from an LHRH agonist of diabetes and premature cardiac events.
Can you talk about what we know right now in terms of management of the man presenting with high-risk prostate cancer and how you approach those patients?
Well, really very much depends upon a man's age. All men who present with high-risk prostate cancer can take one of two paths. Path number one is a surgical approach. They can have their prostate removed, we can have a pathology report, and we can act on the pathology report. If they have their prostate removed, we tell the patient in advance that there's a high chance that additional treatment is going to be unnecessary. We then take a look at the pathology report. If there's obvious extracapsular disease, particularly if there are positive surgical margins, we will recommend the course of adjuvant radiation. Obviously, if there's disease further afield in the lymph nodes, we'll recommend androgen deprivation because they almost certainly have systemic disease. The alternative to that surgical-based approach is to say, well, chances are the surgery isn't going to cure a man. Let's avoid the surgery and lead with radiation. Under these circumstances, we'll use external beam radiation delivered to high dose, as the randomized trials have shown us, is beneficial, and together with androgen deprivation. And the androgen deprivation usually precedes the radiation by 2, 3, 4 months. You just need some degree of regression of the cancer before the radiation is introduced. And depending upon the risk level of the cancer, it may well be considered for 2 or even 3 years afterwards. So those are two differing approaches. Now, the older men, we tend to direct up the non-surgical route. The younger men, I think these days, are more and more being led down a surgical path. And a recent randomized trial that was reported by Ian Thompson from SWOG, and this is a trial that accrued its first patient 22 years ago. So it shows you how long it takes to do a prostate cancer trial and have mature results. But this SWOG trial seems to show a metastasis-free and even a survival advantage for men with these high-risk features after surgery who receive adjuvant radiation. So I think we're going to see more patients with high-risk disease, particularly young ones, having a surgically-based treatment regimen.
What are some of the research strategies that are being looked at to try to improve the outcome of these men?
If we take the surgical approach first of all, there have been many studies looking at neoadjuvant hormone therapy prior to surgery. These have not shown any advantage in terms of survival. And if anything, there may be a theoretical disadvantage because androgen deprivation prior to surgery may hide extracapsular prostate cancer from the pathologist's eye if there's been some regression. It doesn't mean it's not there, it's just hidden from the pathologist. And we may therefore deny a patient important adjuvant therapy as a result. So hormone therapy along with surgery doesn't seem to be the major thrust. And many are looking at chemotherapy in advance of surgery, either with androgen deprivation. Some are even looking at angiogenesis inhibitors, again, in advance of surgery. If you were to take the radiation-based approach, the RTOG is looking at a docetaxel-based chemotherapy following the radiation and together with androgen deprivation in a randomized trial. And that's a randomized trial that's accruing very well.
What's your perspective sort of being outside of medical oncology in terms of how docetaxel sort of stacks up in terms of side effects, toxicity, quality of life? This drug is used a great deal in the adjuvant situation or comparable to the high-risk situation just described in breast cancer. And patients seem to tolerate it pretty well. What about men with prostate cancer?
Well, I think this is a very valid question because if you look at the advantages of treating a man with docetaxel, the survival advantage is a very small one. It's a median advantage of something like a couple of months, which isn't a home run. So one has to look very closely at quality of life. Certainly, my impression from the randomized trials that have had quality of life components is that it is a well-tolerated drug, and certainly that's what I see in my patients. If a man is actually suffering from symptomatic disease, then that's easy, that's a no-brainer. You can give docetaxel, and the morbidity of docetaxel is usually substantially less than the morbidity of his advanced prostate cancer. But it's in that adjuvant setting where I think the real investigation is required.
Let's talk about PSA-only disease. Can you talk about your approach to these patients and some of the investigational approaches right now that you think are promising?
Let's take the situation after surgery. A man has had a radical prostatectomy. Several years have elapsed. The PSA is rising. If the PSA is rising very slowly and there were pathologic features like positive surgical margins to suggest locally persistent disease, then we'll offer a course of salvage radiation. But I have to say that salvage radiation is though it may drive the PSA down in 2/3 of such patients, only keeps it down indefinitely in about 1/3. So we obviously do have to think what's going to happen when the PSA rises subsequently. What I always do is look at the overall time scale of this patient's disease. If it's taken many years for the PSA to rise after surgery, some time for it to come down, stay down, and it's only slowly rising again, those patients we tend to leave alone because their prostate cancer may not be a clinical issue for many, many years, perhaps even decades. And that may be longer than their natural life expectancy. For those whose PSA is going up very rapidly, you know, with a doubling time of every 3 months or less, those men are going to be in clinical trouble or symptomatic trouble in the not-too-distant future, and we don't hold back on hormonal therapy for them. It's that big grey group in the middle for whom we're really fishing around for some options. And I think if you go to any academic centre around the United States, you'll find a different option being tried, anything from PSA vaccines through to dietary methods of slowing down the PSA rise. But I think what's clear is that none of us have a winner just yet.
What about some of the newer hormonal agents that are being looked at?
Well, there are a couple of drugs that are of interest. There was a drug called Abaralex, which was an LHRH antagonist. And the idea of that was that you wouldn't have any problems with flare, and you wouldn't have any problems with a sort of testosterone slowly drifting up again towards the time when the next LHRH agonist shot was due. But that, unfortunately, never received its product license, and I'm not sure where that currently stands. There is a drug that was developed as a result of some basic biochemical studies at the Royal Marsden Hospital in Britain called abiraterone that really has shown some remarkable promise. Patients who have been declared to be hormone refractory then subsequently responding to this drug. That's now part of multi-center trials in the United States and in Britain. We have to remember that most drugs, when they come out of their institution of birth, never do quite as well as they did in early reports. But I certainly think that this drug is going to be a significant addition to the armamentarium. The one trial that we're all waiting for that I think will be, that potentially has a profound impact on men with this kind of disease, is the randomized trial of continuous androgen deprivation against intermittent androgen deprivation. Now, that really is a very intriguing trial. The notion that maybe androgen independence is driven by continuous lack of testosterone, it's a kind of evolutionary response to complete absence of testosterone in the milieu, was first suggested by the group in Vancouver. And they, in early studies in the 1990s, were able to show that the period of androgen responsiveness seemed to be just as long whether you gave the androgen deprivation continuously or intermittently. And certainly for patients, it was much more comfortable to have little episodes when testosterone was around in their bloodstream. This is now being tested in a large intergroup trial. I think the trial is closed, fully accrued, and I think we can look forward to the results sometime in the next year or two.
What are some of the common questions that you're asked by urologists and radiation oncologists about prostate cancer management?
One of the questions I'm most commonly asked is, where does androgen deprivation feature with radiation? Who should get it? Who should get it for how long? And does it matter what kind of radiation they're having? So, for example, if you have a man with low-risk disease, should he ever receive androgen deprivation? And the answer is, probably not. Number one, he may well not need treatment in the first place, and adding an androgen deprivation may simply be overkill, exposing him to risks that he need not otherwise take. We have no evidence that androgen deprivation helps the man with low-risk disease, either when he's treated by brachytherapy or by external beam, although there's an RTOG randomized trial that will likely report next year that will definitively answer that question. For the men with intermediate risk disease, we tend to give 3 to 4 months of androgen deprivation with our radiation preceding it and during, and that's supported by many randomized trials. But those men don't usually need a full 2 years of androgen deprivation. And it may be that if they're given high-dose radiation, they don't need the androgen deprivation at all, but that's an unanswered question. For those with high-risk disease, I think we all pretty universally agree that androgen deprivation is the cornerstone of their treatment and that radiation, external beam radiation, is perhaps the more interesting question, whether that is needed at all on top of the androgen deprivation.